I'm your host, Blake Collier, and on today's episode of 88 Names Podcast, Matt Ruff and I will speak to Mariana Acuna Acosta, co-founder of Glassbox Technologies, about the ins and outs of VR/AR development, where the technology and the tools to develop it are at in access to the masses, and what these technological shifts mean for the greater world. We also dig into how businesses counteract and attempt to prevent bad actors from utilizing this technology for their own purposes, and what role they can and should play in calls for regulation. And finally, what does it look like to be one company amongst many in this burgeoning world of development? In 1929, Edwin Albert Link commercialized the first flight simulator. The construction of the simulator involved a nearly full-scale fuselage and cockpit with accurate flight controls that a person could sit in and control its pneumatic movements, a type of movement by way of air or gas under pressure via a control system, giving the person a sense of actually flying a real plane. Instead of making a person look into a machine to sense three dimensions and movement, Link decided to put the person in a tangible three-dimensional contraption, controlled by the person's actions from within. Not unlike flying an actual plane, except for, you know, not actually being in a plane and flying. The original prototype was built from parts found in his father's automatic piano and organ factory. Nearing the end of his life, he would end up deconstructing one of his Link simulators and using the parts to fix a Link pipe organ, bringing his life beautifully full circle. One might assume that his invention was picked up immediately by innovators in the air and space industry, but this would not be the case. In fact, his original Link trainers would find their way first into amusement parks as just another ride among many. It wouldn't be until this ride's popularity grew in 1934 that the U.S. Army would come calling and eventually purchase six. Thousands upon thousands of pilots were trained on the Link simulator during World War II, and the influence would carry further into the 20th century as the original concept was modernized through the likes of aeronautic and space industries and government organizations. The sensuous nature of the Link trainer would add another building block to what we know as VR and AR technology. Instead of just creating a visual sensation, Edwin Link incorporated the tactile senses of the human body while still creating a divide between flying a simulator and flying an actual plane. Yet if one closed one's eyes in Link's trainer, that difference might have actually been fairly negligible to the body's understanding of its location in its space. Still an illusion, but the transcendence is becoming ever more possible. Link's innovation extended into actual small submersibles that would allow divers to leave and re-enter its cockpit. It would be this invention that would lead to the death of his own son in 1973 when he suffered carbon dioxide poisoning on a dive as he became trapped in debris around a Navy destroyer. Link knew intimately firsthand the unintended consequences of new technology. Link's story brings another aspect of the ever-growing technology of virtual and augmented reality, the inability of the human mind to contain all foresight and consequences of the things they create.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you apply VR within your own company.
That's a large question. Well, right now I am the Chief Product Officer and co-founder of Glassbox Technologies, and we are building off-the-shelf solutions for virtual production and real-time technologies. So basically, we want to give content creators the same exact workflow as if they were in a live action set. And we're using virtual reality as a visualization medium. And I like to call it, I'm hopeful that one of these days I can stop calling it the immersive video assist, because, you know, video village and video assist is a term that's used on a film set or on a TV set where the director can go and visualize what just has been recorded with a film camera. So hopefully one of these days they can remove the video part of it because people will know exactly what I mean. So of course now with virtual reality, it gives you the ability to be immersed in your virtual environment with your virtual characters and be able to check the performances, the lighting, the effects. So basically everything, right? Since everything is now computer generated, you have the same ability, but even better because you are fully immersed inside of your scene. Wonderful. So that's how we're using virtual reality right now.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, there's a business convention and technology convention in Las Vegas that has featured virtual reality tech since the early 2000s. It's called CES. You might have heard of it.
Yes.
How has interaction with VR and the means of content creation changed in the last decade?
I mean, it's incredible how fast like technology has moved forward, because I started to use virtual reality in 2013. I was working for a big software company, also for the entertainment industry. Okay. And so I was helping content creators just with like stitching, you know, live action, like 360 videos, basically, and just with like stitching, even be able to like track elements correctly and be able to do, you know, kind of simple comps for, you know, adding titles or really simple visual effects for their, you know, for their 360 videos. And that was back then in 2013, you know, the filmmakers that were really embracing virtual reality were 3D printing their own rigs and pasting, you know, six GoPros or four GoPros together and really going for it, you know, like really diving in. And then fast forward, you know, obviously the cameras started getting better with things like the OSO, which quickly kind of failed, but, and Jaunt and the G-Halo, which was the first generation camera from Google, which then turned into the Odyssey and the Jump Team. But to me, it kind of like everything escalated. It felt like, of course, you know, virtual reality and everything research has been going on since the 60s, but it just felt like from 2013 to 2016, everybody was like diving in it, and then it just kind of like the technology really escalated really quickly. And then of course at the beginning you started to see very kind of like very simple interactions with things like hotspots and things like that, and then of course fast forward to now you have full-on, you know, high-end virtual reality experiences that are fully interactive that can just blow your mind, or they're just the graphics themselves and the headsets themselves have just gone, you know, have just really gone. The scale of the quality of the work and the hardware has really just moved forward in a real rapid way.
So I wanted to talk a little more about the content creation possibilities, particularly for people interested in getting into this. I'm old enough to remember a time when it was possible for single individuals or two or three person teams to create cutting edge computer games, because at the time the state of the art was so primitive. The TRS-80 I was messing around with as a teenager had 48 kilobytes of RAM, not megabytes. Kilobytes. And so if you're making a game on something like that, you didn't have to worry about sound design because it didn't have speakers, and you didn't have to worry about art design because the only graphics were, you know, specialized ASCII characters. But what was great was that people still managed to do really creative, immersive things with that technology. And I don't want to get overly nostalgic. Like, I wouldn't want to go back because the things you can do now are so much more amazing. But part of the price of that sophistication is that these days it feels more like film production in terms of the resources, the personnel you need to create even a modest video game, you know, immersive experience. It feels like the credits are going to be very long at the end of the game, going to be dozens of individuals doing this. And there's still room for individuals in sort of the modding community, but it feels like it's much more of a team sport than when I was a kid. And so what I'm wondering with VR experiences, if I were an introverted 12-year-old again, and I was interested in getting into this and in creating my own polished VR experiences, is that something that there will be tools for to do something like that? Or am I going to have to just find a team to work with?
I mean, I know exactly what you mean, and you just made me remember of using the floppy disk that, you know, you were able to put 3 megabytes and you were like, yay, 3 megs, and you were just like so happy about it. So I know exactly what you mean. It's hard to say. It's like I feel like it's a double-edged sword, because on the one end, even though of course it's still prohibited for a lot of people, but let's just say that right now you can get the Oculus Quest and you have tools like Medium and Quill, and you can really do an incredible experience with that. And if you know how to, I mean, I don't feel like you even need how to draw, as long as you understand, you know, a spatial relation, and as long as you have some sort of, you know, you have some talent and creativity and you have a story to tell, you can create something really compelling just using those three tools, which is, you know, again, may still be inaccessible for a lot of people, but it still be accessible for, you know, like a teenager that really wants to create something that's visually stunning. However, if you want to do, I've had sometimes people come out and ask me that they want to do like an escape room in virtual reality and using Unreal Engine, and they have this like really, I mean, it's not that complicated of a story, but of course the interactivity and the level of realism that they want to use, they will definitely need a team of people and really high-end desktops and, you know, really expensive graphics cards and a lot of different hardware. So I guess it's a double-edged sword, in which now it's kind of like a commoditization of the tools. They're so readily available that, you know, it may be accessible to a lot of people, but you don't have the creative output, as much of a creative output, if you will. Like, look at YouTube, and no offense to YouTube, but I mean, frankly, all of the videos that are in there are not quality videos,
yeah,
right?
That's true.
I mean, they're terrible. There's no production value in them. So yeah, it's a double-edged sword. But so I feel like there's definitely tools available if you really want to do, if you really want to do a stunning piece, and you can, or if you're still, you want to dive into virtual reality and see what content creation in VR is all about. But on the other end, you know, you're absolutely right. You need a team of people, and it's going to cost you an arm and a leg in hardware, software, and, you know, those unicorn technical artists that know game engines and virtual reality. They're not cheap.
I mean, in fairness, even back in the day, the equipment was pretty expensive. I remember that state-of-the-art TRS-80 Model 3 with the 48K of RAM, that was like $900. And then, God forbid you actually wanted a floppy drive, that was like an extra $1,500 for a floppy drive that could hold like 128 kilobytes of RAM storage. So it's like, yeah, it's always been, there's been a high price point of entry, but it's just, yeah, there's more stuff now to know and learn. So
do you think at some point, Mariana, do you think that it will become such a part of the kind of the economic world that those prices will go down, and even people maybe even slightly below poverty line will have access to some of that stuff?
I mean, I think so, and I would hope so, right?
Yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you see something like the TV, I mean, even people that are in some really remote villages and tribes in Africa that probably have very few little to eat or mm-hmm. to access to water, they still have a TV, or
yes,
they still manage to have access to a cell phone, because at least they're not completely isolated from the world. And mm-hmm. that, at least that part is empowering, to feel like you can be part of, you know, the bigger picture, not just isolated in this and feel even, you know, and feel bad, even worse about your personal situation. So I would definitely hope so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look at how much like the headset, quite frankly, I don't remember, of course, because it was the DK1, the development version. I don't remember how much it was, like the first, you know, Oculus, but now the Quest is not that expensive versus what it was before, or the Vive, right? The Vive was, what, like almost $1,000, and if you wanted to buy it in places like Australia or Taiwan, it was going for like $1,500. And now, of course, you can also get it for $400, $500 with tax. So I think we're very good at making, you know, toys and hardware and anything made of plastic cheaper and cheaper. So I definitely see that happening, and hopefully that way it can reach a lot more people.
Yeah.
So as a user of VR, I one of the difficulties I've encountered with the current generation of technology is motion sickness, which kind of surprised me, because I've been playing first-person shooters and flight simulators forever and have never had a problem with nausea. But it turns out strapping the screen to your face makes a big difference. And I'm, you know, and it's frustrating because it means that there are whole categories of VR experience like flying that I can't really enjoy yet. And I was wondering, is this a solvable problem? Am I just unlucky to be somebody who's, you know, subject to this, or is it an inherent limitation of the medium? And I was wondering also, are there other physiological deal breakers like that that might make it harder to get VR more widely accepted?
Oh, absolutely. Well, of course, there's the, you know, there's people that wear glasses and that are not going to, that do not have or do not want to use contact lenses. Well, that's for a lot of people, that's a deal breaker. And, you know, it's trying to be solved. But again, it's everybody has a different shape of head. Everybody has a different set of glasses. And I've seen that being a very like prohibitive, something really prohibitive for a percentage of the population. And then in terms of motion sickness, I mean, it was definitely something inherent to the hardware and also to the VR experiences that were out there, especially with like at the beginning with DK1, et cetera, et cetera. However, it has gotten a lot better. But I don't think, for example, I don't get sick. No matter what, I don't get sick. And it's not like I'm in VR 8 hours a day or anything like that. However, there's very sensitive people that will get motion sick right away, even if they're working in this medium. So I don't think I can speak for everyone. I think definitely there is that blockage where there's going to be a big percentage of the population that will get motion sickness. I feel no matter what, it has to do something with the brain. It hasn't been around for that long for studies to be made as to what exactly is that is happening to your brain, where it's something that, you know, you might be more sensitive.
You mentioned glasses. I ended up actually buying the specialized inserts for my headset because I didn't want to have to keep pulling it over my glasses. Is there a reason they don't just have a software fix that can duplicate a prescription in the engine? Or
I mean, they're trying a whole bunch of things. I mean, and of course, even though it's, you know, mixed reality or spatial computing, I've tried it with a headset with like from Magic Leap with their, what do you call it, graded lenses. Mm-hmm. And it's just not not comfortable. It's not ideal. And it's very disconcerting as well. So, and while that's on the hardware side of things, yeah, sure. There are things on the software on the experience side of things that are being tried, but it's still, I mean, I don't think there's, because it's not a one solution fits all.
Right.
Right.
No, it's interesting though. Yeah. And I mean, I think as far as the motion sickness, I think once the untethered headsets are more of a thing, I mean, I don't have any problem when I can match my body movement to what I'm seeing. It's when my eyes are seeing me moving and my body knows I'm not, that I have a problem. So I may never be able to fly comfortably, but at least if I can get an untethered headset and go to a large enough room where I can run around without bashing my head against the wall, that will solve part of the problem. But that's a shame though, that it may be an inherent problem with the medium.
Right. And also, I mean, it also, you have to have a really, great UI. And this is, I've seen it more, the motion sickness as well, like happening with games. And I don't know if it's because they don't, you know, like independent, like game developers, indie VR game developers, if it's because they don't have like enough of a, you know, like a segment to do QA that then they don't realize that this is happening. But I mean, I see what you're saying. And it's also really disconcerting for a lot of people, not only like you're standing up, or in the experience you're sitting, or you're sitting but you're moving around all over the place, and you know, it's very disconcerting for a lot of people, and again that can totally be a deal breaker. But the good thing is, I mean I've never felt that VR was going to be this massively adopted technology for a million reasons that we can discuss if you guys want to go that route. But I'm sure we all know why a lot of those reasons are. I never felt that VR was going to be massively adopted everywhere. However, I do feel that it has potential. It's being used in many, many right ways, like training, simulation, education, automobile, design, real estate, therapy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that like its usage, it will continue to grow. And maybe it won't be that much as in entertainment, and it won't be like your grandma is going to be sitting around being like, woo! I'm in the Louvre, or I'm in Fiji, or woo, I'm killing robots. I mean, that may never happen. But it will definitely continue to grow in these other areas and in these other verticals for sure.
DRooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. DRooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at DRooted.com.
What are the effects that you see in of VR technology in the world, like the social and cultural elements that have been affected by VR?
I'll say, well, socially, it's definitely changing the way that people are interacting. But at the same time, I feel like it's V2.0 of the internet and chat. Like, I don't know, back in, what was it, 95, 96, mm-hmm. You know, you would start getting like the chat rooms were pretty rustic, right? Pretty rudimentary, just a bunch of people with like weird like names and ads, right? Like sexy, yep. 63 or whatever. And people would go into these chat rooms and then, you know, over time they start to get more sophisticated, and then web cameras, you know, started to come into the picture and whatnot. And now seeing the social VR platforms, for example, like Rec Room and Allspace VR and VR Chat, and kids are making really incredible avatars, and they're doing, you know, it's also like the V2.0 of or the V3, if you will, from Second Life, or from like being all of, you know, multi-online, multiplayer games and whatnot. And kids are making really sophisticated avatars with like amazing shaders. And of course, you're not kind of leaving your house, but it's at the end of the day, you have the ability to now not. You know who this other person is, at least, you know, in some sort of way, because mm-hmm. of course, you know, they may be a 2-foot-tall kangaroo and you're a scarecrow or whatnot, but at least you're now able to be embodied, you're able to interact, yes. You're able to see hand movement, etc. So that's a very interesting social aspect of it. Very recently, I was invited to a birthday party in virtual reality, and there was like a dinner first in a loft in Hong Kong, and then we all went to a club, and then it ended in like the after party was like at this island with like crazy candy canes with lights and a boat, oh, wow, going around. And then the person that was celebrating the birthday all of a sudden like basically turned off a switch, and then from nighttime it went to daylight, and she was like, okay, party's over, everybody go home, thank you for coming, bye, right?
Yeah.
And afterwards, I saw her in real life, and she was super excited. She told me that she was never going to celebrate a birthday party in real life ever again, because she didn't have to clean. She didn't actually have to dress up, but she looked fabulous in her avatar in VR.
Didn't have to cook.
Yeah. She didn't have to cook. She didn't have to spend any money. She didn't have to clean. She didn't feel bad because she wasn't actually, even though we're all drinking, you know, virtual margaritas. Like there was, you know, she wasn't hungover or anything like that. And so she said that she was never going to have a real life birthday party ever again. And I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, this is something that socially.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, it could be an absolute change. And then, of course, you have like kids now that are younger. The younger generations, I feel, will adopt this technology, you know, faster, better. We'll probably get more used to, you know, the headset and how everything works. And we'll get even less motion, you know, we'll get less motion sickness. We'll get less headaches and things like that. And I would hope that schools would adopt VR at a more, you know, that all public schools would adopt VR at a more massive scale, because I think that would be very beneficial for children, quite frankly.
Yeah.
We were talking to another creator, Brandon Oldenburg, and he was talking about using VR as a way of taking, you know, diplomats to trouble sites in the world. Like you could fly a drone in Syria and show them, you know, in a much more tangible way what sorts of problems they're dealing with. And you know, just a way of just sort of concretizing the reality that people around the world are dealing with. And that struck me as a really interesting use of the technology as well. And yeah, in schools, you could not just read about stuff, but actually let people see what they're studying or a version of what they're studying. And that's got a lot of interesting potential.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, of course, journalistic VR I mean, I feel like that was one of the first things that really attracted me to VR, the fact of seeing, just being at this place where there was a lot of conflict in places like Syria or, you know, Egypt, and just being right there. I think that can give you a very different perspective and not make you feel that you are, you can make you feel like you are actually one planet and that you are connected, as opposed to just feeling like everything's not really your problem. Yeah. And so, yeah, and it, I think it also, it's a catalyst for feeling empathy, and maybe, you know, also there, it's been used a lot to try to fight domestic violence, so that men kind of, you switch the roles, and it's, you know, the man's wearing the headsets, but they're actually a woman and they're being attacked by a boyfriend or a husband. And so that has a lot of potential.
What's when the thing I'm getting about a lot of these too is that, yeah, they're, because they are more grounded in a way, it, like, yeah, things like the motion sickness won't be as big of a deal, because it's more, it's not so much about physically doing something as just occupying a different space. And you'll still be moving around, but it won't necessarily be the kind of intense experience that that tends to make you want to, you know, get really ill. So there's a lot of latitude in the social arena for this that doesn't necessarily, you know, necessarily involve stressing people's limbic systems quite so much.
Yeah.
Right. Correct. Another really good use is besides sort of like medical training and all of that, VR therapy, because you can go into therapy, but you are using a different avatar. And a lot of like sexual assault victims are really liking this because they don't feel a bias towards the you know, the therapist. Okay. There's no bias on sexual orientation. There's no bias on gender. You know, there's basically, you remove the bias and you just concentrate on being able to express why you're in therapy, and the therapist can just concentrate on giving you therapy without having all those different, you know, biases and walls that you're already, you know, and especially if you're like a traumatized victim of that sort, then it just prevents from that from happening, and you can just concentrate in helping the other person, which I also think it's an incredible use of the technology.
No doubt.
This was something else that actually came up in when I was working on this book, because one of the things that struck me about going from text to voice communication in games, in some ways that's a really cool step forward, but it's also in a way a step back, because text has no gender. But if you are a woman and your voice is being projected in a video game, sometimes that, you know, people will start to treat you differently. And so part of me was wondering if there will come a point where, in addition to choosing your physical appearance, whether you will want to be able to control how you sound to other people, to either, you know, disguise who you are or just make it irrelevant. And
absolutely. I mean, I was just thinking about that, because there's actually been quite a few cases of harassment inside of VR once they can hear that you are a woman. Mm-hmm. And even though, what's interesting too, is like the women felt, even as helpless and kind of froze, and they just felt really like something that would happen in real life, where you would freeze and you wouldn't know how to react and all of that, even though you're in a virtual space and you are perfectly capable of, first of all, just ignoring it and just turning around or whatever else. Which I felt it was really interesting that even though you're in this virtual space, you still have the same physical reactions as if it was happening in real life. But I think you're totally on the dot. And I feel audio has not been moving forward as fast as the rest of the technology in virtual reality. And that should definitely change. And actually, to remove, I mean, I'm totally there with you. And I don't know how you guys feel about audio in general, if you agree or disagree with the statement, but I feel that's been very lacking in general since the very beginning, and, you know, for the past 10 years. Sound can definitely get you out of the suspension of disbelief. Audio can, you know, it's still not really immersive. It's still not 360. And unless you see it in, like, you know, at a place like Sundance or Tribeca,
yeah,
it is very rare. Like, those have, like, audio has not kept up with the technology, I feel.
I don't have the appreciation enough for that, but I can definitely see where it would be important. And I probably don't pay as much attention to it. Because I'm more of a prose guy, so that sound doesn't, I don't think about it as much. But yeah, it definitely would be something to think about.
So we're seeing a lot of technology and social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Google, Amazon, and others struggling to address abuse of their platforms. Are VR companies like Glassbox learning any lessons from these other companies, and what should they take away?
Oof, I mean, yes. Do you remember the? I don't know if you actually read the terms of what do you call it? The agreement terms, terms and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
From the first release headset from Oculus, it was quite scary.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I don't remember the, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was basically like, not only were you giving them access to basically tracking your head movement, your eye movement, your it was kind of like a body heat situation, a thermal heat situation that you were giving them access to. So now it was body heat thermal data. But also anything that you watch, they had access to the, I don't remember the specifics, but it was super scary. It was basically like they had access to your body, your eyes, your like where everything you moved, everything you watched. And if you created something specifically for the Oculus, for example, you were basically giving up the rights to any kind of control of your data. So of course, we use virtual reality just as a visualization medium, because we also understand that a lot of people have issues not only with the antisocial aspect of it, but also for the germophobic aspect of it, the glasses, et cetera, et cetera. That's why you just use it that way. But unfortunately, we are not the developers of the hardware, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that even as a company, if you try to be as legit as you possibly can, then it doesn't really matter, because you're not the owner of of the actual product. And there was two companies that were just kind of they were trying to be the platform to be like the clean data. You know, you're the owner of your own data, the platform for VR. And unfortunately, they went under after being around for just a year. And that's, of course, we go to like, how do you compete with, or how do you go against people like companies like Facebook and, and Amazon or Apple, et cetera, et cetera. You can't really survive. If you're a small startup, there's no way to go against these guys. Like, quite frankly, and this is one of the social platforms from Facebook in VR, like, I haven't really wanted to go, like, dive into that, just because I'm really grossed out by Facebook in general. Yeah. And yeah.
I keep forgetting that Oculus is part of Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Jeez. No, they've tried very hard to make you forget, but they're not. And if you read those terms of conditions, I wish I would have like taken a screenshot of those first, because there was an absolute outcry and then they changed it. But of course, I mean, they're probably hidden in there somewhere. They were in the back. They put it in, you put the headset on there in the back and in the lower part.
it's just even smaller text now.
Yeah, exactly.
Keeping with this thing, particularly since the 2016 election, you hear calls for the government to step in and regulate or even break up big companies like Facebook and Amazon. And, something I touched on in my novel is that as VR technology allows more and more realistic simulations of things like sex and violence, that there's almost inevitably going to be a moral panic and calls for legislation about that. And, on the one hand, I think it's perfectly reasonable to have discussions about that, particularly where children are concerned. The problem is that politicians tend to be narcissists who, don't let their own ignorance of a subject get in the way of making demands. So for example, it's very common for politicians to call for some sort of backdoor and encryption scheme so that the FBI, if they want to, can break in and listen to supposed terrorists. And when you explain to them, well, you can't put in a backdoor on encryption for the FBI without also putting in a backdoor that foreign governments or criminals could possibly use? And the response to that is often, well, of course you can. You're a nerd. You just need to nerd harder until you do that. So is government regulation something you ever think about in your work? Is it, you know, are there cases where you might welcome it or worry about it? Or is it just not relevant yet to what you do?
Well, I'm actually part of, because of CES, I'm actually part of the, on the one hand, on AI, and then on the VR, AR, MR, I guess. They don't call it the XR, but they just call it all the, you know, AR, VR, MR. From CES, we're part of all the different groups that we are working with Washington to see about legislations and read and actually and give our feedback and our opinions or all the different bills that are being put forward. VR is really not being as taken as seriously, I feel, as artificial intelligence. And even artificial intelligence, I mean, what is clear is that there's not enough people in Washington or politicians to really understand the technology. And this is why, you know, at the end of the day, this is what Facebook and Apple and all the rest have become, these giants that then they can't live without at the end of the day. And I mean, if you remember like Mark Zuckerberg testifying towards Congress, it was clear that Congress didn't even how Facebook actually worked. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, like, he worked really hard not to laugh on some of the questions that they were asking him. And so not only from my company and for the clients and customers that we service, but, you know, as a content creator, as a mom, as a person in this world, we, you know, of course, I want to be included in how these bills are written and what these regulations are all about and how to protect our data and our privacy and our digital rights. Because, like, the European Union is definitely way beyond the United States in terms of digital rights, and they've actually come out with a Bill of Rights for digital for your digital persona, which I think is totally spot on, and that is incredible how the U.S. has not caught up with that. Because at the end of the day, we could be getting, of course, we're more than happy to give all our data. And I mean, there's no privacy. Let's face it. There is no privacy. There is no privacy. Okay, well, then let's get paid for the data that you're using to, you know, enrich yourself and not pay taxes and all of these things. So absolutely. So I'm part of these different groups. And there is something that does worry me. And also because, you know, I have a son, I want him to live in a better world, or at least try. But with how technology changes and seeing what happened in the elections of 2016 and how Facebook was just like so involved in basically just, you know, messing with an election, and then now with deep fakes and everything else, if you work in the tech industry, I think you have an obligation to try to see where these bills are going and what's happening in Washington and try to help out for all of those, you know, regular folks, if we want virtual reality, for example, to be massively adopted or at least be more accessible to the regular public, well, then you should also be part of making sure that it is something like safe and that it's not going to turn into something, into an episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I will keep my fingers crossed on that, but yeah.
Are all of the VR companies, including yours, in a space where they are working together to develop this technology, or is there more of a competitive element within the market, like most other tech markets? And how does this relationship with other companies help and or hinder the technology's development and potential need for ethical standards?
There is definitely a need for ethical standards, and I think And again, with these groups that are part of CES, we are trying to, like, ethics is a big part of it. And we have put forward different documents about it quarterly and whatnot. And again, for artificial intelligence, it's even more important to be ethical about it, right? Yeah. And more inclusive and whatnot. However, when it comes to it, I would say 50-50, because on the one end, I do feel I am very lucky in the industry that I work in, the tech industry, but also like it's the entertainment industry. Yeah. And because everything has kind of joined together, whether you're working on games or only VR experiences or visual effects or animation or virtual production or TikTok videos or, you know, yeah, YouTube video, or you're one of the VTubers, you, at the end of the day, is, even though it sounds like incredibly big, it's, and of course, well, let's include AR and MR. It's not really that big of an industry, and everybody knows each other. So we definitely love to help each other out. The people that are doing volumetric capture, the people that are doing photogrammetry, okay, or the people, you know, we all kind of help each other out. So there's really a lot of camaraderie. And there's a lot of, yeah, there's definitely, we try to make each other succeed in what our skills and what we're best at, in our, yeah, you know, making our skill sets shine. But on the other end, there's also that I feel like it's a little bit more on the bigger companies that feel threatened by smaller companies, by technology that you have, or because they want to just get you into, kind of corner you into one ecosystem or another, where, for example, companies like mine, we're just software and hardware agnostic. And we, yeah, want to play nice with everyone. We just want you to be able to use the right tool for the right job. Yeah. And that may not be seen, you know, very, very, very well by bigger companies, because they're trying to like kind of corner you into their ecosystem and whatnot. And they, you know, they may try to get you to switch or something like that. But at the end of the day, if we have continued with this ethos since the very beginning, and it's definitely served us well. So I feel there was always going to be that, you know, those bigger companies that feel threatened. Mm-hmm. And of course, you're always going to have competition for other companies that are maybe kind of in the same space as yours, or companies overseas that may try to copy you and, you know, make cheaper technology and whatnot. But at the end of the day, if you have a great team of people and you're creating great products, and you're passionate about what you're doing, I do feel that you can succeed. Mm-hmm. And if, especially if you continue on this, you know, it's like Dharma. If you yourself help other companies succeed and help each other out, then it just creates a virtuous circle instead of the opposite.
So finally, just looking ahead at the next, you know, 5-10 years, do you have a wish list of advancements or developments in VR that you hope to see or would like to see? Like if you had the unlimited research budget to just focus on stuff, like what kinds of things are you interested in? And also, are there any concerns that we haven't already touched on? So like, what's your dream scenario and what's your nightmare scenario for the future of this technology?
Okay, let's talk about the nightmare scenario for a second. Of course, leaving aside like the profound non-beneficial results of machine learning AI and, yeah, you know, private data harvesting and not having privacy, let's leave all of that aside. But for example, I was just thinking about this. It was GDC 2017, and there were the people that were showing there was the VR floor, and they didn't have any wipes and they weren't cleaning the headsets. Oh, I myself got a really bad eye infection, and turns out that there was pink eye going around. Now you can even, yeah, you can even get ocular herpes from a headset. And so right now, a lot of schools that were teaching virtual reality at a teenager, like, or in college level, so like high school and college level, in places like Japan and Australia, places that are closer to China, have completely canceled the courses that they were teaching on virtual reality. So now you have teachers that are instructors that are jobless, kids that are not going to be like learning the technology, that were very excited about it, that had already paid for these courses. And then you have all these like hardware and software that's going to be left around without, you know, being touched. Why? Because of the coronavirus. Yeah. However, like my nightmare scenario, which I don't know how we would solve that. And I do think about it like quite often when I go to places like Sundance or NAB or Tribeca or GDC, CES, oh my God, CES, right? Because would you stop? I mean, you are basically putting a headset on your face, which is like right in your eyes, right in your nose, right in your mouth. So So how would you actually spread? I mean, headsets, just think about it. Like that year in GDC, the headsets were culpable for giving pink eye and eye infections too. It was something, we were something like 250 and people.
And you're going to sweat when you use those. There's just no way around it.
Right. So that's my nightmare scenario with virtual reality. And how do you even, you know, how do you control it? I mean, yeah. I don't see a solution unless you guys have some, you know.
A free headset for everyone that they can use just themselves. Yeah, exactly. That's basically it.
Right. So that's my nightmare scenario. In a world where we live with, where I have like absolutely all the resources in the world, my ideal scenario would be that it's easy to create and deploy VR experiences, whether that's animation or interactive or live action or a combination of it all, where they make it really easy to deploy to all platforms. Because unfortunately, I feel that all these different, you know, headsets, especially, you know, it was especially a couple of years ago when it was like what was the name of this terrible headset? Star VR. And, you know, it was like all these people were coming up with these headsets. And it was like, nobody needs more headsets. What we need is more content. What we need is to make it easier, like the barrier of entry, and also for, you know, content creators of all kinds to be able to learn how to use these tools. So tools that are more intuitive with UI that is made for actually the space of building in 360, not because, you know, a lot of tools have also just migrated from being from 2D into virtual reality. And I'm sorry, but that's not how it works, because the UI is completely different. And it's not the same as doing click, click, click with a mouse in a monitor than having a UI for the next century and for the next generation of creators, right? Which is your 360 UI, so that it makes sense. So more intuitive tools, easier to use, easier to deploy for all platforms. Like really, I mean, if we can do everything with one, you know, with one click now, we can get, you know, it's Amazon, it's Prime now, because I want my things now, yeah, right this second. And it's just like with one click, right? Like Postmates and food and get whatever you want with one click. Well, why can't we have one click and then have it deployed to all the different platforms, all the different headsets, without making it a nightmare, yeah, for the creators to, because again, like this costs money and resources and time for, you know, for example, everybody, including myself, that have created content for the Rift. Now it's completely, you know, deprecated for the Quest. And I'm not going to like redo everything just so that I can deploy it into the Quest. And that seems kind of counterintuitive, or for the Sony PlayStation, right? Because that's the one that has the most, like for developing for the PlayStation VR, it's actually one of the most cumbersome and difficult things you can do. And that is the one platform that actually has the most viewers. So
I'm surprised that the Quest and the Rift are not, yeah, I guess because one is a later generation of technology, that's why it's deprecated.
Right. But again, you know, it's not like we're there. It's not like the iPhone 10 and the iPhone XR. You know what I mean? It's like we're not there. I mean, there was hardly that much content in the Oculus store for the Rift to begin with, to then make it, you know, to then make it so that everything that you had developed for the Rift is now you have to redo it for the Quest. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense, because that means that a lot of, you know, independent creators are not going to be able to redo those experiences. And my ideal world is we're living in a world where, you know, it's easier access, easier to use, friendlier tools. It's like, I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I mean, you guys ask me, it's a one-click button and you can, everything's like, your experience can get deployed to the Sony PlayStation, to the Quest, to the Rift, to whatever, all the different Vives, all the different Oculus, all the different headsets that are out there, including if there's one now, like the Oculus Go, even though that one doesn't exist anymore, but, you know, so something of the likes. Lastly, ideally for me, it would be that every public school in, you know, at least in the developed countries, because, you know, in the third world countries, obviously, like, they have bigger problems than teaching virtual reality, but at least in the developed countries, that in all public schools, that kids would have access to virtual reality, because I think it would be a better way to teach kids about empathy, social VR, and, you know, and just show them the world in a different way, and making learning a lot easier to digest and a lot, like, you know, friendlier and probably a lot more, you know, interactive and dynamic. And you could learn a lot more and a lot faster, I feel. At least a few subjects, you know?
Yeah, it almost seems like your kind of ideals fit with kind of your answer to the issues around competition. You know, the bigger monopolies are like trying to make you proprietary to them. And it seems like your ideal situation is there's just no proprietary. If you develop a program or something, you can use it regardless of whatever headset or whatever system you have.
And, I would love that. Yeah,
exactly.
So universal access, but germ-proof.
Yeah, germ-proof.
Yes. That's right. Or at least, you know, wipes and hand sanitizers for all.
that's probably the better, the more practical solution. So we'll see if we get there.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people still complain about the resolution and how it's, you know, that some headsets say that they're 8K, but they're really not. And I don't really worry about that because at the end of the day, I mean, just as you were saying about the games, I mean, I started playing video games when I was 7 and it was Atari games and I loved Pac-Man, everything. Yeah. I'm a big fan of 8-bit, you know, I played all the games and I was really happy playing those games. And you see now how it's changed. And imagine now, of course, the games that you're going to have with, you know, RTX and all of that. I mean, it's just incredible. So I'm not really worried about the resolution because I know that that's, you know.
That stuff's going to get better inevitably.
Yeah, exactly.
And in the meantime, it's already at that tipping point, at least for me, where the immersion is good enough. I mean, I coming from the TRS-80, this is heaven.
right.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. We will be back next Friday with a new episode. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles. We would like to thank Threaded Zebra Agency, AltSpace VR, Drooted, and Creative Mornings for their support and work on this podcast. We will see you soon.